Welcome back. It's the second hour of Issues Etc. Scott Klusendorf joins us here in just a moment. We're going to talk about the creation of 17 new colonies of human embryonic stem cells. And the key word here for us to bear in mind here is embryonic stem cells. Not just stem cells, but embryonic stem cells that is taken from human embryos. And they're not just plucked like flowers, folks. They are taken after the human embryo is destroyed. Harvard University researchers have announced this most recently. You've seen it in the Washington Post story that appeared in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch today. Scott Klusendorf will join us here in the next half hour of the program. Peter LaBarbera joins us. We're going to talk about the U.S. Senate race in Illinois. Fitzgerald is not running again. This leaves an open spot. Lots of people want that spot, Republican and Democrat. There are several hot-button issues that affect the various party candidates in various ways. You may have read about it. Kevin McDermott wrote about it in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch as well. We'll be talking with Peter LaBarbera of the Illinois Family Institute in Glen Ellyn, Illinois, about that. And then we've got open lines for your questions and your comments. The question I'm laying before you for open lines: if you were, okay, you're a Christian, and your job is you work at City Hall in San Francisco. You know what's been going on at City Hall in San Francisco for the last 2 weeks, don't you? The issuance of marriage licenses, sometimes the performance of marriages. It's not just one person out there cranking out marriage licenses. The mayor isn't doing it himself. Lots of people working at City Hall are working together in order to do this. In fact, the early stories told us that a lot of people are coming in, employees of the city, volunteering to do this. But let's say you're a Christian working there. What do you do? What do you do? That's your question, and I'd like your answer during open line starting in the third hour of Issues Etc. today. Now, I was just reading from the Washington Post, and this is a story from late last week. NIH says, the National Institutes of Health says, few stem cell colonies likely available for research. The approved lines made back in the very beginning of the Bush administration were failing, and the NIH was worried that there wouldn't be enough stem cell lines. Here in the paper today, the Washington Post story, pool of embryonic stem cell lines widens. We're going to talk about it with Scott Klusendorf. He's director of bioethics for Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California. Scott, welcome back. Scott, first of all, people read about this, stem cells, embryonic stem cells, human cloning, all of this stuff, and it boggles the mind. Why should I care that a group of Harvard researchers have announced that they created 17 new colonies of embryonic stem cells?
Because once we buy into the definition that human beings only have value instrumentally rather than because they're intrinsically valued because they're made in God's image, then what we have is the basis for human rights in general is eroded. So, for example, if I'm going to say that these embryos are not valuable and are not subjects of rights because they're small and less developed and don't function yet with self-awareness, what happens to me if I should lose one of those properties? I, too, could then become a subject for experimentation. So the embryonic stem cell debate is really a debate about how we're going to define human value. Are we going to define it as being intrinsically valuable in virtue of the kind of thing it is, or only instrumentally valuable in terms of its utility to others?
Give us a little history lesson on how we get to the point of saying, yes, there's federal money for some stem cell lines, and then there are all these research organizations like the one at Harvard trying to find ways around the restrictions placed early in the Bush administration on federal funding for stem cell, embryonic stem cell research.
Happened, Todd, was that in August of 2001, President Bush put a moratorium on all federal money for embryonic stem cell research. In other words, there would no longer be federal funds applied to continuance of embryonic stem cell research. However, he did allow for federal funds to apply to those stem cells already developed from embryos. So those stem cell lines that were already in existence at the time of his August 2001 presidential executive order, those stem cell lines could be subject to federal funds. However, researchers have claimed, erroneously I think, that these stem cell lines are not adequate. And as a result, they are insisting that we need more. Now, of course, they can't use federal funds to do it because of what President Bush laid down. So what they've done now is, at Harvard, they have taken private money, developed these cells from embryos, and then they're going to give them away rather than sell them. And in essence, some would say it's an indirect challenge. I don't know that it is, but it's still troubling ethically that we have these stem cells being used and they're taken from human embryos. Is it a direct challenge to President Bush's executive order? I don't know, but it's still ethically troubling because we have human beings being killed simply because their body parts are useful to someone else.
Okay, I'm going to ask you to apply your expertise in kind of unraveling the way that this is often presented to us in the media, and I would like you to translate, if you would, one paragraph from the story I have before me from the Washington Post talking about what happened at the Harvard Research Center. The Harvard team received from a local fertility clinic 344 3-day-old to 5-day-old human embryos donated for research use. The team was able to pluck stem cells from the cores of 97 of them, and 17 of those samples grew into stable, self-replenishing colonies or lines of stem cells. Would you translate this for us, please?
Yeah, what they did is they took several hundred human embryos that were, quote, leftover, or to use the clinical term, excess embryos. These are embryos that are left over from fertility clinics. A couple is having trouble getting pregnant, so what they do is they go through a series of reproductive-assisted technologies that's designed to make them have children. And what sometimes happens in some of these technologies is you end up with leftover embryos that are created outside of the womb, and now the question becomes, what do we do with them? Well, you really only have a couple of options. Immediately, the embryos are frozen, and then the couple must decide, do we donate them to research, meaning the embryos will be destroyed, or do we try to adopt them out to another couple that would like to have children but can't? Right now, those are your only two options. And most couples opt for research. They're sold a bill of goods. They're told by the physician that if you donate these embryos, you can take a tragic situation that has caused you a great deal of emotional grief, and some good can come of it. What they don't do is put these couples through any kind of rigorous moral reasoning where they ask the question, what are these embryos? Well, they're human beings. Is it okay to treat human beings that way? Well, the answer is no. So what we end up with are couples who, in their moment of crisis, are sold a bill of goods, and then these embryos are donated for destructive research. So what they've done in Harvard is take embryos that are unwanted and that were going to be discarded, and now they discard them for the purpose of medical research. So that's what all that is in that paragraph you just read me.
I am intrigued by the way that the writer of this story describes or fails to describe what really happens. I read again. The team was able to pluck stem cells from the cores of 97 of the human embryos. It sounds like they're picking flowers or grapes off of a grapevine.
Yeah, what they don't tell you is that in order to get those stem cells, you have to kill a living human embryo to get them. And, of course, the morality of this is not hard to figure out. As I've said before, if I have a bad eye and you, Todd, have a good eye, I don't have a right to forcibly take your good eye to make my bad eye feel better. And what's going on here is if these embryos are human beings, and we can make a good argument they are, both scientifically and philosophically, if they are in fact human beings, then to kill them to benefit other human beings is a gross moral violation. But the couples involved that are donating these embryos that are left over and donating them to research are not being told that they ought to think morally. They're only being given scientific promises, and these promises are really far-fetched. We don't have any evidence yet that there is going to be any therapeutic application for embryonic stem cell research. It's just not there yet. It's a lot of speculation, and the argument is, well, we've got to at least try this, so let's not let moral concerns get in the way. But of course, once you go down that road, what's wrong with the Tuskegee experiments of the 1920s, where we promised black men who were suffering from syphilis a cure, but then we withheld the cure so that we could study how the disease killed them. Clearly that was wrong, and most people would say that was wrong. I don't see how that, in theory, is much different than what we're talking about here. we're saying it's okay to set aside our moral concerns about the status of these human embryos so that we can progress with our scientific research. That's dangerous thinking, and that's why it's a concern to all of us.
Before we go on, I'd like you to make that scientific and philosophical case that the human embryo is, in fact, a full human being, equivalent in every way to you, to me, to any other human being. But first, make the distinction between embryonic stem cell research and stem cell research, or sometimes called adult stem cell research.
Yeah, good distinction. Stem cell research is not, by definition, evil. There's good stem cell research that's morally acceptable, and there's bad stem cell research that's not. The bad stem cell research means we take a human embryo and we grow it to about the 14-day stage, and then we kill it so that we can extract its stem cells to treat disease and others. Stem cells are the basic building blocks of the body, and it's believed that these primitive cells can be used to treat disease in adult humans. The other kind of stem cell research involves taking already existing stem cells in the adult, extracting those stem cells from the adult's body, which, by the way, unlike embryonic stem cell research, does not kill the person that's making the donation. We can take stem cells out of your body and mine, and we don't have to die in the process. Embryos do, in fact, die when we extract their stem cells. So with adult stem cell research, what happens is we remove the stem cells and then we implant them in the bodies of people suffering from illness, and we are finding that those stem cells appear to function quite well. It's still very, very early in the research process, both on the adult side and the embryonic side, but I will tell you, Todd, there is absolutely no clear evidence right now that embryonic stem cell research is going to work. But even if it does, and it may, let's grant that it may down the road work, it still can't get around the moral objection that it's wrong to take the life of one human being so that another human being can benefit.
We live in this pragmatic, utilitarian age in which it's not considered a huge leap by the average person between, look, if it can work and if we can do it, then the ethics be damned. If we can achieve some sort of good, put it in terms, you used the analogy just a minute ago about I have a good eye, you got a bad eye, you just take my eye. Put it in terms that we can understand to debunk this notion. Look, let's say embryonic stem cell research does become a miracle cure. Why shouldn't we still do it?
Well, it gets back to the key question here. Do we do evil that good may come of it? Let's take it a step further. What if we could line up 10 toddlers and just kill them and save the world from all other diseases? Ought we do that? Coming from a biblical worldview, the answer clearly is no. The ends don't justify the means here. And we can't kill 10 innocent human people just so other people can benefit. We could go another way. Let's say that we had a bunch of sociopaths and other people suffering from mental illness that could be cured if we took a bunch of toddlers and tortured them in front of all these sick people. Let's say we could fill a stadium full of people that were suffering from mental illness, and they would all get well if we tortured one toddler in front of them all. Would that be acceptable? Well, of course not. We cannot do evil that good may come of it. So the point here is that if there isn't an intrinsic value to human beings that says to us we need to respect them even if it brings benefit to us, then none of us have a secure right to life, because at any moment someone may be able to show that our deaths may contribute to the betterment of others. And by the way, who gets to decide who the ones are that must sacrifice themselves and the ones that should receive benefit? That, too, is left undefined.
Okay. Someone says, look, I'm still not convinced that the human embryo is a human being. Let's make the case both scientifically and philosophically.
Scientifically, this isn't difficult, because if you survey embryonic textbooks around the world, you will find that they can be summed up in a sentence, and that sentence goes like this. From the earliest stages of development, the unborn human is a distinct, living, and whole human being. It comes from human parents. It's distinct, living, and whole. Now, that doesn't mean it's mature yet. It still has to grow and develop, but it's a whole human being nonetheless. It's not part of another human being like somatic cells that I pluck off my hand or sperm or egg cells. It is itself already a distinct living and whole human being. Now, that in a nutshell is the scientific case. What some people try to do is inject metaphysics here and say, okay, it's biologically a human organism, but it doesn't have the moral status of a person yet. And, of course, that makes an additional claim that they need to defend, and I want to know what the difference is between a human being that is not a person and a human being that is. I want to know what the difference between the two of those things are, and they have to argue for that. What they usually end up saying is, well, the embryo is biologically human, but it's not a person because it's too small or it's not developed enough or it's too dependent. But if size determines the rights that we have, Todd, then I guess Shaquille O'Neal is more valuable than Celine Dion. If level of development is what makes us valuable, wouldn't it follow that those with greater intellectual prowess and physical prowess have a greater right to life than those of us who are not gifted in those areas? And if development is what makes us valuable, or the ability to live independent of anyone or anything, then we got a problem because we've got lots of people running around outside of the womb that depend on all kinds of medications without which they can't survive. The problem is, anytime you take some accidental property like self-awareness, development, viability, and make that the decisive factor, you don't just rule out embryos, you rule out people outside of the womb as well. And this is why this debate over embryonic stem cell research is absolutely critical to your listeners. What's at stake here is not just what do we do with embryos. What's at stake here is how we define human beings. Are they subjects of rights in virtue of the kind of thing they are, creatures made in God's image, or are they only valuable for what they can do functionally? And if that latter definition wins the day, you can kiss goodbye any concept of natural rights, meaning those rights that humans have simply because they're human. And now it will be the strong and powerful who define who gets a right to life. And I will tell you right now, they will not stop with embryos.
In a practical sense, someone says, look, this is going to move forward, if not in the United States with private money, it's going to move forward elsewhere in the world, already is, with public and private money. Someone is out there saying, look, America doesn't want to get left behind in this. We don't want to be the odd man out in this brave new world of biotech research.
Well, I guess we could argue that in the 1940s, Germany was leading the world in terms of medical studies on how people died from various methods of execution. They would line up 40 Jews, shoot the first guy through the head, and measure how far the bullet would travel through each of the succeeding skulls. They would drop people in freezing cold water to see how long it would take it to kill them. Germany was clearly leading the medical field in a lot of ways back in the 1940s, but I don't think any of us would argue the United States should have duplicated those experiments in order to keep pace with what the Nazis were doing. All of this idea that we need to keep pace with the world begs the question and assumes that human beings are not valuable for what they are. It doesn't prove that. It simply assumes it and then challenges us to try to keep pace with the rest of the world. But wait a minute. If we're doing something that's wrong and evil, why would we want to keep pace with the rest of the world? Pol Pot killed millions of, or hundreds of thousands of people in Cambodia. Did we try to keep pace with that? I mean, we have to ask the moral question before we ask the technological question.
Unless we gloss over this and miss a point that perhaps we should have made a little earlier when we were talking about the origins of these Harvard stem cell lines and the human embryos involved, the 344 so-called spare embryos, there's the issue of in vitro fertilization to deal with and the way that the fertility industry is contributing to this problem.
Well, it is a problem. I think that you bring up a good point here. I'm looking at the same article you referenced a moment ago. And what was interesting is the doctor who did this at Harvard, Dr. Douglas Melton, argued that these were frozen embryos that were going to be discarded. They were going to be killed anyway. And his argument is at least we're putting them to good use. Well, that's pretty bad reasoning, if you ask me. Death row prisoners are going to die anyway. Do we cut them up and use them for medical experiments prior to their executions. I mean, soldiers that are wounded mortally on a battlefield will die, but it doesn't follow from that we use them for grisly medical experiments. So this line of reasoning is very suspect. By the way, why are these embryos going to die? Because people like Douglas Melton are going to kill them. So it's really bizarre reasoning on his part. I do share your view, Todd, that reproductive technologies such as in vitro fertilization can pose a problem, but I don't think they're evil in and of themselves.
Explain that, because that's very important to make this point.
Yeah. The problem here is we lack the moral reasoning to support our technology. We have in America today a technological morality that says if it's doable, it's moral. And I, of course, do not buy into that. A more appropriate way to approach any kind of reproductive technology is to ask, how are we going to treat the embryos that are involved? Now, if a reproductive technology is going to result, A, in excess embryos being discarded, or B, requires us to kill hundreds of thousands of embryos in the process of perfecting the technology, then we have secondary moral considerations that render the procedure morally problematic. And what we have right now is a reproductive technology industry that doesn't ask the moral question, what are we going to do with these embryos and how will we treat them? It simply pushes the technology forward without asking the moral question. That's the problem.
Finally, with only about a minute and a half here, Scott, what was it kind of a fatal compromise for George W. Bush in August of 2001 to say, yeah, the dirty deed is done. Let's put federal money toward even these few lines, but no more. We'll turn off the tap at that point.
I don't think it was a dirty compromise. I think it was the best decision he could have come to at that point, given where votes were going to shake out in the Senate. There was already talk about trying to override him with Senate resolutions, court overrides, that kind of thing. Where I think the president and the Republican Party in general are making a huge mistake right now is they are not arguing for their worldviews. They are stating their views, but they're not arguing for them. And what should have happened after that decision is for the next few weeks leading up to September 11th, which will cut the president some slack on there, but I would have followed in the days immediately following that decision. I would have been in front of the mics. I would have had my presidential spokespeople in front of the mics. I would have had people sympathetic to my view in front of the mics, arguing and educating the American public that humans have value because of the kind of thing they are, and we shouldn't kill small, defenseless, and dependent human beings simply because they don't function like us. And we should have been morally educating the public. And this is one of my big gripes about the Republican Party right now.
We've got just 10 seconds here, Scott.
Yeah, what's happening is they're not educating the public on their positions on taxes, abortion, stem cells, cloning, and they better get serious because the Democrats are going to pound them if they don't.
Scott Klusendorf, always a pleasure talking with you, and thank you for being
here. Good talking to you, Todd.
Scott Klusendorf is Director of Bioethics for Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California. Oh, when we come back, I'll tell you how to get a hold of Scott and Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Perhaps St. Peter is best known for his greatest sin, denying Jesus Christ three times. But the story of St. Peter is really the story of God's grace in Jesus Christ. It's really the story of every Christian. Our Issues Etc. book of the month for March is called Follow Me, Peter Lays Down His Net. It's the story of God's grace shown to St. Peter in Jesus Christ our Savior. This children's book is $12.99 plus shipping and handling. You can order it by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, or visit our website, issuesetc.org. Look under the What's New section. It's our book of the month for March. Follow Me, Peter Lays Down His Net, 1-800-325-3040, or issuesetc.org.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Calling it the greatest human rights scandal of our time, Amnesty International is beginning a campaign to stop violence against women. Sounds good, right? But as Gilbert and Sullivan once said, things are seldom what they seem. Keith Peters has the story.
The campaign is called one of the most important in Amnesty's 43-year history. They say living in safety is a basic human right, but for many women, that right remains out of reach. Executive Director William Schultz.
There is no men-only sign on the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
But their recommendations to end violence against women in their executive summary betray another agenda. They call for the abolition of all laws criminalizing sexual relations in private and restricting women's access to reproductive health care and family planning. Carrie Gordon Earle of Focus on the Family.
Now, most certainly violence against women is something all of us should be concerned about. But Amnesty International also embraces the idea that so-called reproductive rights, which apparently in their book would include abortion, should be part of addressing violence against women.
She says that's something pro-life and pro-family groups could never sign on to. Earle says what is needed to stop violence against women are edifying messages of the true dignity and worth of women worldwide.
If we're going to elevate the status of women, we don't do that through abortion. We don't do that through condoning same-sex relationships. That we really do need a vision of women and the dignity and status of women that is worthy of them as created in the image of God.
And she says Christians need to take a stand on this issue that has been co-opted by the radical left. For Family News in Focus, I'm Keith Peters in Washington.
Amnesty International says it will lobby Congress to reauthorize the Violence Against Women Act and to appropriate funds for the UN Development for Women. It's not known when those issues will be brought back to prominence. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
The members of the St. Louis Alumni Association of Kappa Delta Sorority are proud to host their 21st annual Shamrock event for the prevention of child abuse. Southside Day Nursery has been selected as the local beneficiary of a Shamrock event fundraising effort in St. Louis to be held Saturday, March 20th. Alumni members of Kappa Delta will hold a trivia bowl at 7 p.m. at Webster Hills United Methodist Church Christian Education Center. That's at 698 West Lockwood at Berry Road in Webster Groves.
Issues Etc. is partially underwritten by Concordia Publishing House, publishers of our Book of the Month for March, Follow Me, Peter Lays Down His Net. It's written by Issues Etc. regular guest Pastor Eric Rotman. You can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org and click the What's New section or call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. The book is Follow Me, Peter Lays Down His Net.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., Pastor Andy Emmons joins us again for part two of a three-part series we're doing on the Apostles' Creed. We'll be doing the second article. Now, we did the first article in the first part, obviously, and that was pretty easy going because we only had a dozen words to handle there. Well, the second article, the Creed, being, of course, the focus of the Christian faith, the Son of God, our incarnate Savior, Jesus Christ, is much more expansive. There's much more to deal with, but we will try and get into an hour's conversation with Pastor Randy Emmons of Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights, Illinois. We'll also continue our series on the funeral liturgy with Pastor Will Whedon of St. Paul Lutheran Church in Hamel, Illinois. I know there are many out there who wait with bated breath for the likes of Pastor Whedon when he comes on the air. And I've gotten some excellent response from you, our listeners, on the funeral liturgy. One of those kind of things you just don't hear elsewhere on Christian radio. You never will. Except on Issues, Etc. And we have the next installment, part two of our seven-part series on the funeral liturgy, Christians, and death with Pastor Will Whedon tomorrow on Issues, Etc. Well, the U.S. Senate race in Illinois is going to be interesting because the field of candidates on both sides of the aisle are huge, trying to take one spot. Fitzgerald will not be running again. He's leaving vacant a Senate seat. There are some hot-button issues facing both parties in this key Senate race, and Peter LaBarba joins us, Executive Director of the Illinois Family Institute based in Glen Ellyn, Illinois, to walk through some of those hot issues and how they will affect that race for U.S. Senate. Peter, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Todd. Great to be here.
First of all, how significant is this vacant seat in the U.S. Senate?
Well, Todd, this is huge. This is absolutely huge, and I know you know a lot of the reasons why. One thing is the judges. We're going to be considering the judicial nominees have been locked up a lot of times by the Democratic leadership. Just the judges alone, it would be a huge race because the Republican seat that's held right now, if that gets lost to a Democrat, there will be further trouble in the judges depending on how the other seats go in the nation. But that's part of it. Also, we've got the federal marriage amendment that will be considered. All sorts of things coming up in the Senate that will be impacted by this.
So if a Republican takes Fitzgerald's place, of course, there's no net gain from that alone.
Right.
The bigger issue is whether or not the Republicans can hold that seat. What would that mean if they lost, if only that seat, to the Democrats?
Well, you know, I don't know how the rest of the seats are looking. I haven't consulted a political journal lately, but it's just very important because the loss of any seat, and we're a nonpartisan organization, I should say, Todd.
Sure.
Just to be fair, we support Democrats and Republicans who support family values. But I've looked at the Democratic field in this race on the Senate side, and let me tell you, there's some left-wing stuff there, Todd. In fact, I just noticed that Blair Hull sponsored. He was the leading guy on the Democratic side. He sponsored a homosexual fundraiser in Chicago recently. In fact, he was listed as the top sponsor on the website of a homosexual fundraiser. Now, you would never see a Republican do that. And then I just see Barack Obama, who's the leader now, I guess, in the polls. I have to survey the gay literature, what they're saying on their side. And I noticed a big big quarter-page ad by Barack Obama boasting about all the pro-homosexual things he's done. So this is really an important race from an idea perspective. And then if you bring abortion in there, of course, that's crucial as well. The Republican field, at least the leaders, Jack Ryan, these are pro-life men. And the Democratic side, they're pro-abortion rights.
Okay, let's talk about both of those hot-button issues, abortion and the gay rights issue. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch story by Kevin McDermott seems to say, look, the gay rights issue and the gay marriage issue has the potential to hurt one side of this race, whereas the abortion issue has the potential to hurt the other side. Sort it out for us, if you will.
Well, you know, they say that about abortion. I haven't seen the article, but I know what he's probably insinuating that on the Republican side, the gay rights question will help whoever gets the nomination. And that's because polls show that the population of Illinois, like the rest of the country, is deeply opposed to so-called gay marriage. Now, a lot of the Democratic contenders, Todd, it's interesting, like John Kerry, the presidential candidate, the likely presidential candidate, they're saying that they oppose so-called gay marriage. But then they offer nothing to stop it. You know, it's like, they're just saying they want to have it both ways, whereas the Republicans, Jack Ryan, I think, and others, are supporting a constitutional amendment to protect the definition of marriage between one man and one woman. So my question to some of these guys like John Kerry is, well, if you oppose so-called gay marriage, you know, what are you doing to stop it? And I hope that's the way President Bush frames it on his side.
What would the Senate's role, since we're talking about a Senate seat here, what would the Senate's role be in the passage of a U.S. constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage?
You need a two-thirds vote, and so it's and they need a few more to get that passed. Right now it's not going anywhere in this Senate, so they need to pick up senators. So like you said, it would be another – if a Democratic candidate got it, it would likely be another loss in terms of the chance to get those 67 votes for the amendment. Now, on the abortion side, I still think that a candidate who's willing to say – let's say if it's Jack Ryan or if it's Andy McKenna, whoever it is, or Jim Overweis, if they're willing to say and defend their pro-life viewpoint, then that will help them. The way it hurts usually Republicans on the life issue, Todd, is, you know, you get these guys who maybe they say they're pro-life, but it's almost as if they're defensive about it. And I think that's why some people on the liberal side say, well, it's a loser issue for Republicans. But we saw in the last presidential election, they picked up seats. I think it was the vast majority. There was like only one out of the incoming freshmen who was not pro-life. So I think pro-life is a winner for whichever candidate takes that position.
Now, there is a candidate on the Republican side running for this seat, Jonathan Wright, who, unlike the other Republicans running, is a is kind of a no-exceptions pro-life candidate. He calls for no exceptions. He's compared Roe v. Wade to the Dred Scott decision in the 19th century that upheld slavery. And apparently he's not appearing anywhere on the polls. What does that tell you about kind of the no-exceptions position among those who are running, whether they're Democratic or Republican?
Well, you know what? I don't think it tells us anything, Todd, because he has really run a low-level campaign. I mean, in other words, I've heard so many people say so many great things about Jonathan Wright. He's got such an outstanding future, I think, in the party. But he's run a part-time campaign, for all intents and purposes, as I understand it. So I don't really think he's gotten the hearing that some of the other candidates have. I saw him speak once. He's a tremendously impressive individual. And so I think that he's taking the principal position, and I like to see it compared to the Dred Scott decision. I mean, how can we talk about, on the one hand, we want to try people for murder when their unborn children are killed, and yet we allow them to be killed right up to the third trimester in the society? It's grotesque.
Let's walk through very briefly, if we could, the front runners, the apparent front runners in this race for Fitzgerald's seat in the U.S. Senate, starting with the Democratic side. What can you tell us about the front runners there?
Well, I can tell you the little I know. I haven't researched them thoroughly because, as I said, we don't spend a lot of time on partisan politics here at the Illinois Family Institute. But I do know that Blair Hull is ardently pro-abortion, pro-feminist, and pro-homosexual. Now, there's only one candidate, Gary Chico, who's pro-so-called gay marriage, Todd. I think all the other Democratic candidates are thoroughly pro-gay, but they don't take the marriage position. But as I said, this is sort of becoming almost like a ploy, Todd, because, you know, you've got this lawlessness spreading in the United States all over the place. It's only a matter of time before it comes to Illinois. The gay activists in Chicago are already demanding that they be married by the county clerk, even though the law is very clear, passed in 1996, that in Illinois, marriage is between one man and one woman, and no outside homosexual marriages are recognized. I mean, there's a lawlessness spreading out, and in the midst of that lawlessness, you see these candidates saying, well, I'm against gay marriage, but then they denounce and even ridicule any attempt like the marriage amendment to stop it. So that's where I think a lot of the candidates are on the Democratic side. On the Republican side, most are solid on the homosexual issue, but I'm not sure if all of them support the federal marriage amendment. I know Jack Ryan does. I believe Overweis does, and I'm not sure about all the others, but it's much more of a conservative position on that issue. Borlein, I believe, is the only one of all the Republican contenders that are pro-abortion rights.
And the ones that call themselves pro-life, according to their own answers on a survey, what does that mean specifically?
Well, you know, usually it means they oppose to abortion on demand, although, like you said, there's varying levels of that. You know, some people have exceptions on the basis of rape and incest, although, you know, I don't think that is the principal position, because there are some wonderful stories, Todd, and I'm sure you've heard some of them, of people who were born out of a crime, essentially a rape, but their mothers chose to either have them or put them up for adoption. And so it's pretty hard to say that, you know, the baby doesn't deserve life if it came from that unfortunate circumstance, but that is the position of some candidates.
Are there any other issues? I mean, we've been talking about the abortion issue in general and the gay rights, gay marriage issue. Are there any other issues that concern you when it comes to either this Senate race in Illinois or any other open seat in the Senate?
Well, I think that the issue of school choice is huge. It's right now we have experimenting going on in Washington, D.C., where they're going to allow that terribly beaten up school system, and D.C. schools are, I don't know if they're as bad as Chicago, but they're pretty bad, and they're allowing school choice, I think it's vouchers, for the first time. That is a huge issue, because we have to do something to resolve the education problem in this country, and it's so difficult with the liberal unions stopping everything they can, and so that's a critical issue. I think that now I know Overweis has raised the issue of immigration. We don't really get into that much at the Illinois Family Institute, but he seems to have picked up some traction on that, as people are sensing that they're very concerned about the borders and how it is that we are able to keep preserve our freedom if there is this sort of open border system.
Peter, who do you expect will be facing one another for Fitzgerald's open seat?
I think right now, just looking at the polls, it looks like Obama, Barack Obama on the Democratic side versus Jack Ryan. And I like Ryan's chances if that comes out that way, because he's carefully reaching out to the black community in the Chicago area. He's trying to broaden the scope of the Republican Party and get more minorities involved, and I think that's a good thing. Although Obama, you know, he's an attractive candidate. He seems to have a good articulate message. Not a good message from my perspective, but at least he's articulate in framing it. So it should be quite a fight. It is uphill for the Republicans, of course, Todd, because this is a Democratic-leaning state.
Peter LaBarbera is our guest. He's executive director of the Illinois Family Institute based in Glen Ellyn, Illinois. We were talking about the U.S. Senate race in Illinois. I'd like to hear from some of you, our Illinois listeners, in the next 15 minutes. Who are you leaning toward for U.S. Senate seat, that open one that Fitzgerald is vacating? Give us a call, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. What about Illinois as a state, Peter, in the presidential race 2004?
Well, they just had a poll up here, Todd, in the Chicago area where I'm based, saying that it's looking very good for Kerry. Now, I don't think the Republicans should write off Illinois. I think Illinois has a... if they run on some of these pro-family issues, if the issue of marriage comes up, I think that will win support. But let's face it, there's a very strong Democratic machine in Chicago, probably like no other big city machine in the nation, and that pulls a lot of weight for the Democrats. Now, what my prayer and hope is, Todd, is that we can rally people to get the truth out on these issues. We're holding a massive rally. Well, we hope it's massive in Springfield on the 31st of March. We're rallying to protect marriage, the definition as one man and one woman, and we're supporting a constitutional amendment in the state of Illinois to define marriage as between a man and a woman. And we're hoping that we can sort of get the word out to people to, you know, look at what your candidates are supporting. We're encouraging blacks and minorities, look at what some of these Democratic candidates, or whatever party they're from, look at what they're supporting. You know, they say they're for the family, but then they come out and they support abortion rights and the full homosexual agenda. And there needs to be a price paid for that at the ballot box.
Jack Ryan, you named him as a front runner, has a bit of a problem, at least from my perception, and that is he's got a name, not a relation, but a name that is pretty much mud in Illinois right now.
That's why they make the first four letters in his signs Jack with an exclamation point, Todd. And I hope if the race comes down to Obama or whoever versus Ryan, I hope that doesn't become an impediment. But maybe it will, and it's a sad thing that the Republican Party became so corrupt here in Illinois. But I think all of these candidates, whatever one gets the nod in the Republican Party, Todd, I think is going to help clean up this party. Andy McKenna is a man of integrity. I met him. I haven't met all the candidates, but they seem like I'm heartened that there's such a good core of candidates there.
You mentioned before a constitutional amendment to the Illinois Constitution that would define marriage as a man and a woman. What are the realistic chances of that taking place?
Well, we're finding out now that the realistic chances in this year are pretty dim, because the Democratic leadership under Mike Madigan, the Speaker of the House, has squelched this measure. We have had calls pouring into Madigan's office. There are obviously many, many people who want this amendment to be heard and debated in the House, but the Democratic leadership has stymied it. Now, what we're hoping is the pressure will continue and they will allow it to get out. If it doesn't make it in time for the vote in November, Todd, we're hoping about in 2005 or 2006. We're just going to keep pushing forward on the issue of marriage, and hopefully the people will start to see who's holding it up. And the question I have for these guys is, Todd, what do they have to fear? You know, should we allow Mayor Daley in Chicago or his Cook County clerk, David Orr, or some activist judge to tell us in Illinois or whatever state you're in what marriage is? You know, that's not the role of a liberal politician or an activist judge. The judges are supposed to be interpreting the law, not redefining an institution that has stood well for thousands and thousands of years.
Do you expect Chicago or some other major or some other municipality in Illinois to join the ranks of those other states that have been illegally issuing marriage licenses for gay couples?
Well, we were happy to see that the David Orr, who's the county clerk who would be giving out those licenses, he's been a real active guy saying he wants this so-called gay marriage, but he has now stopped short and said he cannot give the marriages out. I mean, you know, it's just law-breaking, if you were. The law is very clear in Illinois. It was passed in 1996, Todd, by an overwhelming vote. There's very strong support for Illinois' defense of marriage law. And so I'm hoping that they don't do it, but actually when they have these radical rallies in downtown Chicago and the word gets out, it does build support, we're hoping, for our side when people say, wait a minute, we've got to do something to permanently take this issue of marriage out of the hands of the liberal politicians who are pandering to the gay activists and the activist judges.
I want to turn in the last few minutes here our attention to what I think is just a perennial problem in Illinois. I happen to be a resident of the state, and that is the laxity of laws on abortion, period, in the state of Illinois, especially compared with our immediate neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about how Illinois fares in terms of laws that restrict abortion, that regulate abortion in any way, as opposed to, say, Missouri or our northern neighbors.
Yeah, I'm new to the state, so I'm not an expert on all of, I should be know more about Illinois law, but I'm not an expert yet, and I certainly don't know enough about Missouri's law, but I do know that you're right, there is a lax standard here. There are laws apparently against viability, aborting viable babies, Todd, and yet we just learned a couple weeks ago that Northwestern University was doing partial birth, so-called abortions, which are actually infanticide. So we do have lax laws. We are having a hard time even getting a vote on a Woman's Right to Know Act here in Illinois, which would allow mothers to see what an abortion is, what is the development of their unborn baby before they go through this abortion. We can't even get a vote on it. It looks like we will not get a vote on a Born Alive Infant Protection Act here in Illinois, Todd, which would make it illegal to kill a baby that's actually birthed, could live through an abortion or any other means. So there is a culture of death here in Illinois. Even though there's a lot of pro-lifers, it's just it seems to move with an inertia, and I'm still seeing what the Illinois Family Institute can do to help resolve that situation.
Specifically, what's the obstacle to those several pieces of proposed legislation that you talked about, the pro-life legislation?
It's the Democratic leadership. I mean, let's be fair. They put it in with regard to the last one. I mean, the Woman's Right to Know Act, it went to a committee, which was there was no chance to get it voted out of that committee. I think they got one vote, or maybe that was the Born Alive Act, Todd. They're put in these committees where somebody told me once, these committees are so liberal, you could promote a measure to kill pro-lifers and they would pass it. I mean, they're being stymied by the Democratic leadership, just like the gay marriage amendment gay marriage amendment that we're trying to get through. They're exercising raw power, and the people have to wake up and get activated and then do something about it on Election Day if there's going to be any change.
What other pro-life legislative goals, no matter how distant they may seem, what other ones do you and Illinois Family Institute have?
Well, I have a heart for the kids, Todd. I would love to see stronger parental rights legislation in schools. We would like to see it to the point where they can't work the gay agenda or the radical feminist agenda into the schools with such ease. I don't know if you saw it, Todd, but they just had the Vagina Monologues, which is a radical and very crude feminist play. It was shown on college campuses throughout the state of Illinois. You know, there's just a lot that gets through, and parents need to get more informed. So we need stronger parental rights laws. We need stronger school choice legislation that will allow parents to move their kids out of corrupt schools. I would love to see pro-life bills get through, starting with the smallest. But, you know, right now we're focusing a lot on the marriage issue because this is just, to many people, this is something that, this is like the Roe v. Wade of our generation, Todd. You know, Roe v. Wade on abortion came in 1973, and you'll remember that the Supreme Court said this would solve the issue. And all it really did was usher in abortion on demand all across the nation and lead to many abortions, millions and millions of abortions that never would have happened. Well, now we're on the verge of a national legalization of homosexual so-called marriage, and the effects that will have on children, on families, on businesses are profound, and we want people to take action to stop that from happening, take proactive action so we're not just sitting back and reacting to it when it does happen.
Finally, Peter, since Fitzgerald is leaving the seat open in for the Senate there in Illinois, evaluate Fitzgerald, the candidate who's leaving. What kind of a senator will whoever takes that seat be? What kind of senator will they be replacing?
Well, I think looking at the Republican field, you will actually probably have a more sort of across-the-board conservative than Fitzgerald now. Peter Fitzgerald did some wonderful things. He supported pro-life, pro-family legislation. He did wonderful things before he got into Washington, sponsor of the Defense of Marriage Act that is on Illinois books right now, which is probably the reason why the Chicago activists are not demanding or not getting so-called marriage licenses right now. On the Democratic side, I hate to be pessimistic, but I think if we get somebody in there, it's going to be somebody along the lines of Dick Durbin, after all, was once pro-life, by the way, Todd, as you probably know, and now they're supporting abortion and homosexuality and these social issues, which we believe are so destructive to the family.
Peter LaBarbera, thank you for your good work, and thanks for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Thanks, Todd. Can I give the website out?
I'll be giving it here in just a moment.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Peter LaBarbera is Executive Director of the Illinois Family Institute based in Glen Ellyn, Illinois. If you'd like to visit their website, it's illinoisfamily.org, illinoisfamily.org. That's the website for the Illinois Family Institute. When we come back from this break, we've got open lines for your questions and your comments, an entire hour for your phone calls here at the end of the first day of this new week, March the 8th. Here's the question for you. It's a very practical question, a kind of question that I imagine there are Christians really dealing with at this very moment. San Francisco, Portland, Seattle just joined the ranks here. A little county down in Arizona, a little county up in New York, and who knows, by the end of the day, maybe a few more places. Courthouses where state and municipal officials are saying, look, to heck with the DOMA laws, to heck with all of what's going on in the country, we're just going to start cranking out the marriage licenses. Let's take San Francisco, for example. You, as a Christian, work there at the courthouse. The mayor says it's time to start giving out the gay marriage licenses. What do you do? I want your answer to that question when we come back. It's open lines for your questions and your comments. We'll also be hearing from the 60 Minutes Ed Bradley interview with Gene Robinson. It was broadcast last night. We'll give you a few bites from that to get things going during open lines after this.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.